President Trump made Saudi Arabia his first stop on his first presidential trip abroad. The Saudis continue to drop U.S. bombs on neighboring Kuwait, and this week they cut diplomatic relations with their ally, Qatar. KCSB's Harry Lawton talked to Professor Shireen Ghatali of UCSB's History Department to find out what lies behind the current turmoil in the Middle East.
Following President Trump's recent visit to Saudi Arabia, where he signed a $100 billion arms deal with the Saudi monarchy, I talked with UCSB history professor Shireen Ghatali, a specialist on Middle East politics and history, about the significance and the symbolism of this visit. Professor Ghatali first pointed out that Trump finds himself most comfortable among autocrats and the trappings of extreme luxury. Among his other best friends in the Middle East are the military dictator of Egypt, General Sisi, and the would-be absolute ruler of Turkey, Recep Tayyip Erdogan. She also pointed out that in the Middle East, regimes such as the Saudis have always boosted their power by channeling oil revenues into the powerful military forces as part of their hegemony. That $100 billion arms deal signed in Riyadh is all part of this pattern and fits in with the Trump policy of boosting US business interests abroad, in this case, the arms industry.
From the beginning of the history of the finding of oil and its interaction and its significance to corporate and state interests, whether in the Middle East or in the United States and Britain, whether in the context of, you know, turn of the century Iran or 1930s Arabian Peninsula, in all of these contexts, there's been an almost immediate immense amount of capital that these regimes have used to build up a militarized and to militarize their states and build up their armies. So this is what happened, during the Shah's regime in Iran, where Iran became actually at that time before the 79 revolution, the Islamic Revolution of 1979 became the fifth largest army in the world. After, in particular, the October 73 war, much of the money and the profits that the Arabian Peninsula were making were really funneled into armament. And so actually what winds up happening is that a lot of this profit gets cycled back into U.S. corporations. Now, of course, Saudi Arabia, I mean, one of its weaknesses, as with all of the Gulfs, is that the actual population, the native population or the indigenous population, is very small, and most of these Gulf countries rely on immigrant labor at all levels, from the white collar to the blue collar, and to what many have, I think, rightly talked about as a modern form of slavery, particularly in domestic situations, but not confined to that. So I think in many ways, the armament, the building up of their military power has been, again, important since the inception of the Saudi state. But at this particular moment, they are engaged in a war in Yemen, in which we see once again sort of these relatively new categories of the quote-unquote Sunni Arab states fighting off the Shia interests of Iran and its affiliates, although, of course, the landscape and the politics of all of this is much more complicated.
What about the war in Yemen, with Saudi Arabia shelling civilian targets with American and French and British bombs, a campaign now 2 years old, with devastating civilian casualties? Professor Ghatali points out the Saudi opposition, indeed their fear, of popular uprisings, the Arab Spring, from 2010 in Egypt, Tunisia, Libya and elsewhere. The Saudis were determined the virus of democracy would not spread to the monarchy, and this explains their close alliance to Sisi's military takeover in Egypt. This fear also helps to explain the Saudis' diplomatic assault on the Kingdom of Qatar over the past weekend.
We forget about the very important role that the uprisings played and Saudi Arabia's role in responding to the Arab uprisings, which began in Tunisia in December 2010. And the Saudis were very much opposed to the revolutionary forces, and we're very much opposed to the democratically elected Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt. And so they played a very important counter-revolutionary force in Egypt and throughout the Arab world, whereas a country like Qatar actually attempted to support in many ways the Brotherhood. And this is what this recent break between most of the Gulf countries, with the exception of Kuwait, is around these issues around Qatar's sort of thorny relationship to the Muslim Brotherhood.
On the question as to who is supporting whom in Yemen, the answer is not crystal clear. But what can be said is that the rebel Houthis, supported by Iran, are just one of a number of genuinely subordinate groups in the Middle East who are demanding power after decades, indeed more, of oppression. The tragic fact is that, trapped between contending forces, it is the ordinary civilians in Yemen who are paying the price in terms of the destruction of their communities, the ruin of infrastructure. Professor Saikali also points out to the outbreak of cholera in Yemen, which in current circumstances, given the bombing and the blockade of essential medical supplies, is out of control.
Party interests. So I think that, it's very difficult, especially for a non-expert like me, to really give a sense of the complexities, except to say that the label of terrorism, and that the kind of singling out of Iran, and at this particular moment, Qatar, is really, in many ways, the kettle, the pot calling the kettle black, right? And people really, all of these regimes speaking out of both sides of their mouth. People who pay the price are the Yemenis and Iraqis and the Egyptians.
Yeah, not only on the chin, they're having...
Exactly, and now the, rise of cholera and all of these, the very real threat of famine and all of these things that are ironic, in the 21st century, something that we should certainly be able to contain and avoid altogether.
What animates the Saudi hostility towards Qatar that has caused it to cut diplomatic relations and to blockade the tiny kingdom this past weekend? In fact, from their point of view, there are many points of irritation. Qatar has given to taking a softer line on Shia Iran, the sworn enemy of the Saudis. Qatar has also harboured certain Muslim Brotherhood leaders expelled from Egypt. And above all, Qatar finances the independent radio outlet Al Jazeera that has criticised legal violations in Egypt and supported democratic initiatives throughout the region.
And also having a media network such as, primarily known to American audiences, Jazeera, and especially Jazeera Arabic, which has really been a sort of thorn in the sides of the Saudis in particular. And even though now it tends particularly... in the last 4 years, it tends to be much more of a propaganda tool than it was before. It still threatens the Saudi regime in particular ways. So I think, all of these kinds of singular reasons need to be put into a broader picture to also understand the way that Qatar has attempted to play the force of a regional power, whether it's in terms of its massive media network and the significance of that media network during the Arab uprisings, or in terms of the ways that it's attempting to act as a counterpart to Saudi Arabia's counter-revolutionary actors. I mean, the sad reality of all of this is that there aren't really any clear revolutionary actors that that observers like myself feel like we can support.
Qatar is no perfect democracy, nor are all its foreign policy initiatives completely disinterested. It has annoyed far more powerful regimes who are determined to bring it back into line. Professor Saikali, with a final glance at all the powers jockeying for position in a region in turmoil, is obliged to conclude there are no good guys to back. Nonetheless, we are obliged to pay attention to developments in the region in the hope that the seemingly endless wars in Syria and Yemen will finally come to an end. This is Harry Lawton reporting.